Kia ora and welcome to another podcast in the intriguing series People, Places and the Climate Crisis, a series where I have the great privilege of interviewing 16 outstanding climate experts on climate and local government in the lead up to the local body elections in October. I'm Lindsay Wood from the Resilience Climate Trust, and we're running this series in conjunction with Fresh FM, the top of the South's community access radio station. At the end of the podcast, I'll give you details of other ways you can listen if you wish. But now it's time for this interview with Kapiti Coast District Councillor Sophie Hanford, who is a remarkable person, and I hope you get as much out of it as I did. I found her an inspiration to listen to. She's the second of our guests on the theme Visualising the Future and Championing Change. The first was Professor James Renwick. And so do enjoy Sophie Hanford. The name Sophie Hanford might sound familiar, even if you can't pinpoint why. And why is likely to be that in 2019, Sophie, at just 18, jumped to national prominence as she spearheaded the inspirational Fridays for the Future movement. The same year, she was chosen as Joint Wellingtonian of the Year and was elected to Kapiti Coast District Council as one of New Zealand's youngest ever elected politicians. Wow. And she'll be standing again in this year's elections. Tēnā koe, Sophie. I see you in the same wonderful echelon as people like Chloe Schwabrick and Nelson's Rowan O'Neill Stevens, a new wave of enlightened and articulate young people that leave an old male like me feeling humbled and hopeful in about equal measure. And thank you so much for sharing your time with us. Welcome to Climate Matters.
Oh, tēnā koe. Thank you so much for the honour. I've been really, really amazed by all of the work that you've been doing in the space, Lindsay. So thank you so much for having me.
Oh, thank you. We're all on a journey, aren't we?
Yeah. Yes, for sure.
We're counting down to the local government elections in October. We know that, and that's partly why I'm interviewing you. And in a much bigger sense, we're also counting down our chances to take truly effective action on climate. For years, a recurring theme has been that local government is the pivotal player in getting the right climate things to happen on the ground. And yet councils the world over are dragging long tails of failed aspirational climate policies. How important do you feel is the role of councils in this arena, and what do you think is needed to make them truly effective in that role?
Oh, it's a great question and a clanger of a one to begin with, because it really does.
Sorry.
It's perfect, but it really does kind of set the tone for, I know, what will be a really interesting discussion that we'll be able to have. So when I first ran for council in 2019, I was 18 years old. I'd just come off this kind of big wave of activism and being a part of a movement of 170,000 people nationwide for climate justice. And then all of a sudden was kind of thrust into this political space with bureaucracy. It's bureaucracy ridden, it's got process for Africa, it's got all of these things that if not kind of used or manufactured in the right way can really halt progress on an issue which is requiring our action now. And obviously we don't have time to wait for slow progress, because it's climate action and climate justice now that is required. So I feel like the role of councils, it was something that I was pretty kind of oblivious to, but I knew that I was oblivious to before I ran for council as an 18-year-old. I have now started to better understand how councils can really be the grassroots voice for our communities, for both the impacts but also the solutions, and bringing our community along for that journey. And I think, the role of councils is kind of often overlooked, because we see these big shifts that need to happen at a nationwide level. For example, our kind of mode shift changes and our shifts towards more sustainable fuels and shift away from fossil fuels. But those changes at a transformational level nationally need to manifest at a local level.
Totally.
And communities need to be brought along. So I think that really what councils need to be able to do better to allow that to happen for us to create low emissions communities of the future is that we recognise the crucial importance of taking action now, that councils become more agile. Currently, councils, in my view, don't have the ability to move and mould around the challenges of the day and allow the voices of those that most need to be heard to be at the table. For example, our young people, we know that climate change is an issue which we have a huge stake in. So let young people lead, let Indigenous communities lead. And currently the model of councils is very kind of one size fits all, and it all fits into the Local Government Act, and that's the act that we are governed by. We're also constrained by many other things. Mm. And so I think councils need to become a lot more agile and a lot more ambitious through hopefully using that agility for the right purpose to really be kind of the community drivers of the change that needs to happen and community leaders in this space.
Oh, that's a wonderful answer, and I do wish you high success on that quest, because it's very much needed. And anyway, that's great, and we'll touch base on that theme in a couple of questions' time anyway. Mm-hmm. Out of interest, one of our recent episodes was for the Minister of Climate Change, James Shaw, and in different words, he said much the same thing as you were saying about community ownership and participation, not particularly young people or Indigenous communities, but he was very much in favour of processes that allowed citizens to take ownership of what was happening.
Yeah, and be able to see the impact of their action or inaction too, because we need people to feel like they can be a part of the solutions, not just to feel completely paralyzed by the scale of the crisis or not understand their role in perpetuating it. We need people to understand that at a community level and at a national level, that there are things that they can do, as well as raising their voice as loud as they possibly can to the people who need to hear it, they can do that.
People exploring climate strategy quickly realize that hard calls have to be made, and that many of them will be unpopular even when they're well-founded. For example, reducing private car use or reprioritizing public expenditure or even putting sea level rise notices on properties. This places an enormous burden and I think a potential conflict on elected politicians. How do you think councils should approach this dilemma so as to have the best chance of establishing strong, long-term climate policies and then critically following through and implementing them?
Oh, another big question that has required a bit of reflection actually and figuring out how I might tackle this one. One of the biggest things that I think is important for local government to sit within a context of is really strong leadership at a central government level, because ultimately, if we've got this kind of people-powered democracy hopefully happening in a climate-just world down at the local level, that will need to be supported by overarching coordination and facilitation and accountability from central government. And ultimately, I think the relationship that those two layers have is extremely important, and one which we haven't necessarily got right in terms of how we both mitigate and adapt to climate change. And I think, it'll definitely be a dilemma. And as well as the fact that because at the moment, the majority of our community, I feel like, is still in the is an issue which, we don't need to be spending money on now. We just need to be lowering rates. There's this whole mentality around things that are good for us now will be what's good for the next generation. I think the more we can embed intergenerational planning into everything that we do, the better our decision-making will be for those of us alive now. And I think that's a real mindset shift that if we can start to show leadership in, albeit potentially unpopular, it will hopefully ensure that future elected members who hold these roles won't have to face the same sort of challenges. And I know that I have faced and some of my colleagues have too. So I think it does start from having some people in there who are willing to be courageous and who are willing to stand up and say, you know what, this is what needs to happen. And you might not be thanking us now, but actually your tamariki, those who follow you, the next generation will be thanking those of us who did stand up and who did say and do what was right. So I think we need to have that central government layer that is really, really strong in its accountability as to how local government needs to be a part of the solution. So it's not always you know, brought onto the doorsteps of us all of that concern and angst from the community. But we also need to find ways of communicating creatively to our community about the need to not only consider, you know, our generations and those of us alive now, but those that will follow.
Oh, yes. You won't know this, but people listening to this on the radio will just have heard James Renwick, who is bracketed with you, to talk about on this theme. And what you've just said resonates so well with what he said. And that one of his opening comments was he thought that local government should be flooded with resources by central government, partly to take the political ping pong of elections out of the equation. And in a way that not different logic, but looking at a different perspective, but very much resonates with what you've just said, doesn't it?
Completely. And it also takes out potentially the kind of political kind of colours or sides from this, because it isn't just an issue that, you know, the left wing people who are into politics should care about, or it's not just an issue for, you know, those of us who live in coastal communities to be concerned of as well. It's, very much needs to be that all local councils are flooded with that resource, because with the challenges that come with climate change and its impact, we will see across New Zealand communities impacted in different ways, but they need to be given the agency to respond to that in whatever way they see best.
Oh, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think you mentioned the term just transition earlier on, or climate justice, and I think that's a common term, but a lot of people will immediately think, oh, that's a very poor community that's got to move or something like that. But it may equally be in the frame of what you've just said. It may be a farmer on a river flat that's got to completely abandon a long-term family farm or something like that. So it'll affect everybody. No, great answer, thank you. I want to jump to diversity, because you're a great champion of diversity and that really resonates with me. However, diverse councils do bring their own challenges, for example, reconciling widely different views or values, or some councils have a comfortable status quo and then diversity challenges that. What do you see as the key ingredients to achieving a well-integrated council that can thrive in this context? And what are the indicators that climate-savvy voters might look for that suggest a council is or is not functioning well in a diversity sense? I'm trying to put you on the spot there, Sophie.
No. This is great. There's a few questions wrapped up into that one. And I would first like to acknowledge, too, that while there are elements within diversity as a concept that I can proudly champion as a young person, I am also, you know, a white young person from a relatively, you know, well-off place in Aotearoa, New Zealand. I've had a pretty good upbringing and have had the resources to be able to get myself into a place like this where I'm able to have these conversations. And so it's important to recognize that there's a whole lot of diversity that I will not represent, and that, when we think about true diversity, that looks like, it looks very intersectional. It looks like a diversity of race, of ability, of perspective, of age, of, you know, sexuality. We could talk across that for
totally.
But if I think about the question in there about the key ingredients to achieving a well-integrated council thriving in a context of diversity, I would say communication, like simple as that. Being able to have really open and honest dialogue with holding respect for one another and the perspectives that we bring. I personally am lucky that I felt really well respected and valued within a local government context.
Right. Right.
Not really what I expected. I kind of expected that, you know, the adults in there would put me down and disregard me because of my age. But I felt like because people have openly communicated and allowed me to communicate my perspective, that as long as you've got that kind of whakawhanaungatanga base that you're acting from, where we know each other and we know what each other is bringing into the space, we're kind of on that shared platform to begin with. And the key indicators for climate savvy voters, I guess, to recognize whether their council is taking kind of that intersectional action on climate change that incorporates diversity, I would say just ask questions and look at what, you know, the council has invested in. For example, when I first got onto council, the main climate investment we were making was into EV infrastructure, which is which is fine, which is good. But what about, you know, embedding climate change and its considerations within everything we're doing? Where's the investment into ensuring that that happens? Where's the investment into ensuring that our staff have the education that they need to do their work in a te tiriti-based way and in a way that is centred around you know, knowledge of what our planet needs? So we need to make sure that investment isn't just siloed, but that it instead sits in and across everything. And that isn't just including sustainability as well. It's recognising that to ensure a just transition, we can recognise climate change as not just an issue that needs to be solved, but an opportunity to reduce other social and economic inequalities. And so councils need to be investing, I believe, in a wide range of solutions which sit underneath an umbrella of climate action. So look to that and see what your council's doing in relation to that within their long-term plan. And that'll give you a pretty good indicator.
Lovely answer. And I love it doubly because it gives me a perfect segue into the next question.
Perfect.
And here it comes. Although many issues local authorities must deal with are multidimensional, and we know that climate change connects pretty well everything, councils tend to operate in a pretty siloed departments like infrastructure, parks and reserves, etc. I see that departmentalisation as sometimes impeding the sort of holistic approach a climate strategy may require, or as you've just said, other strategies may require. Please give listeners some insight as to how councils handle multifaceted issues and what structural or procedural changes might help achieve a more integrated approach to climate responses.
Oh, see, this is an interesting question too, because you've mentioned some of the silos there, like in terms of departments, but there are also kind of silos that exist within the power structures and the ways in which councils are set up, where you've got a chief executive, you've got, you know, all these staff members, then you've got the mayor, then you've got the councillors. And so there's kind of like funny relationships and just different ways of working that aren't particularly common in other workplaces. So currently how councils handle multifaceted issues, in my experience, has been again through real silos and almost focused on achieving things through process, but not actually distinguishing between process and purpose. Like it feels like there are so many processes that are supposed to serve a purpose, but we don't see it. And we don't, like, I'm just like, well, if we need to make this decision and we all want to make the decision, can't we just do that now? Mm-hmm. Or no, but it needs this report and it needs this, and we need to understand the extent of this. And I understand that with information comes power, but also we have enough information and enough evidence that climate change is literally the defining moment of our time, that it is already causing mass biodiversity crises and crises for people around the globe who are on the front lines of the impact. And so what we get when we have the siloed kind of approach to things is there are only some teams that are aware of that because it's just something they're interested in. The other people kind of are able to and choose to turn a bit of a blind eye to what we know is the reality, or they instead kind of blame it on needing more information or not having everything at hand. But we do. And ultimately it's councillors' decisions as to what we want to move forth with. And we should be able to do that. But I think currently, the silos really don't help, because as you say, if we're trying to create solutions that are sustainable and holistic, if we only change one of the silos, well, that's just so much. And it takes us, you know, this much effort, like so much effort, and we've just got to change all the other silos. Why don't we, you know, figure out a more kind of circular and holistic way of doing that? As to the structural and procedural changes that I think might help achieve a more integrated approach, I think we can really look to Indigenous kind of knowledge and way of processing things and coming to decisions. I think that the ways in which councils currently kind of base their decisions is very much on almost what I, when I first was elected, really saw as kind of academic information. But I think there's so much more information and understanding that we inherently have as people that we must bring into decision making. We cannot leave that experience at the door. And especially staff, you know, staff can't leave that experience at the door either, our council staff. And so I think, yeah, having a slightly less structured way of being able to respond to these challenges so that, yeah, we're not waiting months and months for a report that then helps to inform another report that then helps to inform maybe putting in some funds into doing something. Mm. It's like, well, we know it needs to be done, so... And there's a really strong case for doing everything that we possibly can in our power to reduce emissions now. Let's in this case just dissolve those silos and recognize collectively it's important. So I think it's about what we value through the process, and it's not about valuing process but valuing purpose. Because yeah, councils are just so comfortable with process. It's kind of like a safety net, it feels like, because you know, you have to be accountable to every decision. You have to, and I totally get that's important as well. I'm not disputing that, you know, at the slightest. I'm just saying that, yeah, we need to instead think about the purpose instead of just getting so caught up in a process that doesn't do anything or achieve anything.
Can I pick up on two things there? One of them, I wouldn't say to you, except that it's in the area you live in. I was driving through Foxton, I think it was, at the end of summer. I'd been camping with my family. And I was thinking about silos, and there on the right, as I was heading south, are these huge silos.
Hello.
So I went and took a photo with the idea of using it in an article. But the thing that I point I wanted to make is massive steel silos for grain, I imagine. But my point was that the connections between them are tiny little spindly bits at the top. And I thought that's quite a metaphor for the way it works. Isn't it? Does that make sense to you?
It very much makes sense. Yes. And the structure. Yeah. And the structures and the systems. That's completely true.
So much bulk and inertia in the silo and this tenuous little hopeful connection between them.
The top of the connection is the most important part.
Yeah, you've got it. I'll flick you that photo, but I'll also post it on our website because it's relevant.
Yeah.
However, the other thing I wanted to pick up on, you talked a couple of times about the process and, oh, we've got to do this and we need so long for that and so on. In Parliament, they have circumstances where they can go into urgency. Yeah. And I wonder if, maybe they are there that I don't know of, but I wonder if local government needs some sort of set of agreed parameters, because there's often good reason, isn't there, for some of those processes.
Yeah.
But they are not dealing with climate change. And therefore, maybe, do you think there's a place for an added or more clear-cut process where people could say, hey, hang on, we have to dispense with some of the conventional process because we've got to make a quick call on this. How does that sound to you?
Yeah, I would say that would definitely assist councils in taking the necessary action. We have things like, you know, we can move a notice of motion, we can put an urgent item on the agenda quite late in the piece. But the problem is allocating the funding through core processes like the annual plan and the long-term plan.
Totally.
It requires community consultation. And yes, it's important that we obviously want to hear what the community thinks, but if we're waiting until the next plan, which means you have to wait a year and then it takes. So yeah, when we already kind of know what needs to happen and if our community then comes back and says, no, we don't want you to spend this money on climate mitigation, well, are we going to say, oh no, we're not going to spend the money on climate mitigation? That would be terrible governance. That would be terrible leadership in the face of a crisis. So why? Yeah, I guess that totally echoes your point about if we know stuff needs to happen, then we need those avenues through which we can make it happen quickly. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that would make sense.
The scientific community, and you've probably heard it as well as I have, is making increasingly strident protests that they've got an abundance of climate science, but it's reflected in a paucity of worthwhile policy. What do you see as the missing links in that chain, and how might that be rectified?
I think one of the things we have to do, because I completely agree that there's, you know, so much now scientific evidence as to the situation worsening, is that we have to make sure that science is communicated in kind of human terms, as well as obviously scientists are human, but that it's communicated in a really easy to understand way for both those in positions of political influence, and also those who, yeah, those who are in our communities, so that they can actually understand the realities. Because, you know, you can hear these stats like there is so many parts per million carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, the global Earth surface temperature is this high, but what does that actually mean? And so I think that's a big link, is the way in which we communicate science, so in science communication. But I also think one of the other links is strong accountability to actually including it in our policy, because there are many people who know, and who know how bad this is. And, you know, the alarm bells continue to sound when we've had Article 6 of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report, and that being coded as essentially code red for humanity. And you know, if that's not a big enough warning, then I don't know what is. And that's in layman's terms. Like, that is a very, you know,
isn't it? That's right. Yeah. That's the siren going off. It's sort of almost abandoned ship, isn't it?
Totally.
Except we can't abandon the ship.
So where's the accountability for local governments to prioritise that? I mean, at a kind of global level, obviously we sign these agreements, we've signed the Paris Agreement, we go to these Conference of the Parties things every year, we're involved in, you know, various processes such as contributing to the IPCC through our body of scientists in New Zealand, but there's really very little accountability. And even if there is, it's like, what are the consequences for not?
Yes.
And we have to build in, there are so many now kind of, and this is one of the things that I found, which was so frustrating participating in APEC, which is the Asia Pacific Economic Cooperation Youth Delegation. And we were talking about various policy that could be implemented at a global level, especially within the Asia Pacific region. And one of the things was ensuring that there were people signing on to a commitment to end subsidies of fossil fuels. And so the end result was a voluntary agreement to slowly phase out the subsidies of fossil. Well, what good is a voluntary agreement?
Yes.
So it's like, it's policy, but it's not good policy.
And so, slowly phasing out is not exactly inspirational stuff either, is it?
No. So I think the biggest, and it's so hard to know exactly where the missing links are within that, because I think it's partly kind of political leaders not feeling like they have the social mandate to say, yeah, we're fully committed to, you know, standing up for this. It might also be, you know, a fear of being re-elected. It might be a fear of not being re-elected, sorry. It might be, yeah, just a fear of those things, which links back to the question earlier that you asked. But again, I think science communication is a big one, because if our communities understand, our communities will help to put pressure on our elected leaders. Our elected leaders will feel more comfortable and confident to take courageous action. But it also has to happen the other way around, where our leaders go, actually, we're going to be courageous. We know this is what's best.
Yeah, I'm completely with you. And I think it's almost like we need the balance to shift in the electorate to say, we actually want people to push us through the hard stuff. We have to, it's like a dingo running through the fire a little bit, isn't it? We have to go for it rather than keep thinking, oh, not yet, and so on.
Yes. And the other thing too that the Climate Commission found or came to the conclusion on is that if we act now, it's going to be a whole lot easier and better for the economy and better for the reasons that people tout for not taking action in the long run. Whereas if we don't, it's going to be so much harder to make that transition, especially with us.
Yeah, and it's frustrating when you see it clearly, isn't it? And it's still such a hurdle to get across. Sophie, I could ask you lots of follow-up questions, but I'm going to tip into the end. And it's been lovely spending time with you. And I have got a final question for you. But I just want to say that I hope listeners can hear your energy coming through in your words, because I'm enjoying seeing you animated. We're on Zoom for those people that don't know. And you're speaking with so much energy. It's a delight. So I'm sure the words will convey that. But I just want listeners to be aware of that as well. Anyway, as a final opportunity, one of the things I love about having specialists like you in all sorts of different fields is that I can invite you to say, what is your top take-home message? If you want listeners, particularly to factor climate change into their voting selections, what would you most like them to have in their hearts or their heads? Over to you.
Ooh, I would say, this is a great question. I would say be courageous in asking the questions. Like, just simply put the question to those who are running. What will be your priorities in terms of achieving climate justice for our district, for our city, for our community? And ask those questions not only on behalf of yourself and your wider community, but on behalf of the next generation, on behalf of the planet, on behalf of the, beautiful nature that we have the opportunity to share this place with. I would say, yeah, use your voice as much as you can through asking the tough questions, because it's likely that people who are sitting in those seats at those candidate debates, and I would recommend going along to those as well, that they'll be having the similar kind of questions ruminating. But, it's just going to take a few people to start to set the narrative. So I would say, yeah, you've got nothing to lose and potentially so much to gain. And even if you're considering standing for local government and you have some of these aspirations and ideals that we've talked about over the last 30 minutes or so, again, nothing to lose and so much to potentially gain. So, yeah, think about the planet, think about the next generation, think about, nature and wildlife when you ask those questions, and have courage of your conviction that they need to have an answer, because they do. People who are standing for local government and these elections and for central government must have an answer to that question, because, it's literally the issue of our time. And if they have no plan to tackle it, then I doubt they're going to have much vision for what else they're going to do with their role. So put the question and expect an answer. And if you don't get one, keep following up.
Brilliant. That's fantastic. Thanks. Sophie, I just wanted to flick back to something that you said a little bit earlier, and that was happily what a good introduction you had to your time as a local government politician, and that you felt supported and perhaps more than you even expected. However, there's quite a lot in the press, and I've noticed it lately, about the hard time given to young people in politics, and especially given to women in politics. It seems to be a misogynist element that's pervading. And I can imagine that being a deterrent for people, and especially young people, and putting their hand up to be counted in election time. Do you have a message for people like that as to how they should think about the prospects and how they might face up to them if they encounter them?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's something that I almost started preparing myself for, almost expecting it coming into the role. And I did get it a little bit on the campaign trail. But one of the biggest kind of pieces of advice that I would give probably is that you do have support. You will have support. There are people like myself and other young elected members and incredible wahine toa who are also on councils across New Zealand who will be here to, pick up the phone if you've had a hard day, because yes, there will be hard days, but there are in life generally. So it gives us an opportunity to practice resilience and to learn and grow. But ultimately, in these places, we shouldn't have to put up with behaviour that kind of is threatening to or actually bringing us down. Because, local government should be a place where all voices are able to coexist. And that doesn't mean, getting rid of those who make up the majority of local government now. It means having those voices there, but alongside voices of our youth, of our Indigenous communities, of our disabled communities, and them being all in the same space. So I would say one of the biggest things is just, that you would not be in it alone by any means. You've got a tribe. There are those of us who haven't had experiences. There are those of us who have. Sometimes I find just being able to talk things through is really helpful. But the thing that keeps me going really through some of the challenging times has just been reminding myself of why I'm doing it, and reminding myself that it's about the long game, but also that we all have a responsibility to stand up for those silly comments that have no foundation and are often just by people who also don't know a whole lot about what we as elected members do. We can kind of disassociate while standing up and standing strong against that kind of stuff, and just making it a place where instead we belong and not where that kind of horrible talk and stereotypes and ways of thinking about people who are different to us belongs. Like, it's just not conducive to good decision making for our next generation and our people and our planet. So I would say actually it's a great way to stand up against that stuff. If you have a strong view that it's not welcome in local government, then we have to be in there to say, nah, leave us alone. we're doing the work.
Wonderful. Good answer. And as you were talking, I was thinking in a way that sort of harassing and so on is the antithesis of the diversity that we were talking about before, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Sophie. It's been a great pleasure. I've enjoyed our conversation. I'd like to keep chatting for ages, but all good things have to come to an end. So tēnā koe, thank you very much for your time and good luck in October.
Kia ora, thank you.
Well, what a remarkable person. She really gives someone like me a lot of hope that if we have people like that around, maybe the future's in good hands, even though it's a bit of a challenging future. Anyway, as always, I said that I'd give you listening options for the series. You can listen to the full interview with each guest on their own podcast, and these are available on Spotify, Apple, and other main platforms, and they can be linked from my firm's website, which is at www.resilience, that's R-E-S-I-L-I-E-N-Z, resilience.co.nz, where you can navigate easily to our podcast page. That will also give you a full schedule of the podcasts and the radio episodes, plus some background information, as well as information on Fresh FM broadcasting frequencies and to podcasts of the radio shows, where most of the interviews are condensed to about half their length. As always, a big thanks to Kahu Sanson-Burnett, who does a great job as the sound tech and as the podcast whiz. And of course, a big thanks to you, our listeners. Thank you so much for joining this really important discussion. We have many more fascinating experts coming up on the series, and I do hope we enjoy your company for them too, including next up, Professor Emeritus Pat Bodger, who's a retired professor of electric power engineering, and he is talking, or I'm interviewing him, on the theme of energy and climate resilience. So I hope we have your company again for that next episode. And as always, kia kaha for the climate.